Hello, my name is Butch Ball, volunteer reader with the Virginia Voice. Welcome to today's music news. Read a passing of note this week, Chris Gustafson. The article that I'm going to read is an obituary in the New York Times. Chris Gustafson, country singer, songwriter, and actor, dies at 88. He wrote songs for hundreds of other artists, including me and Bobby McGee, for Janis Joplin, and Sunday Morning Coming Down, for Johnny Cash, before a second act in film. This article was written by Bill Friskies Warren. Bill Friskies Warren writes about country music for the New York Times from Nashville. It was published on September 29, 2024. Chris Gustafson, the singer and songwriter whose literary but plain-spoken compositions infuse country music with rarely heard candor and depth, and who would later have a successful second career in movies. He died on Saturday at his home on Maui, Hawaii. He was 88. His death was announced by E.B. McFarlane, a spokesman who did not give a cause. Hundreds of artists have recorded Mr. Christopherson's songs, Al Green, The Grateful Dead, Michael Bublé, and Gladys Knight and the Pips, just to name a few. Mr. Christopherson's breakthrough as a songwriter came with For the Good Times, a bittersweet ballad that topped the country chart and reached the top 40 on the pop chart for Ray Price in 1970. Later that year, his Sunday Morning Coming Down became a number one country hit for his friend and mentor, Johnny Cash. Mr. Cash memorably intoned the song's indelible opening couplet. Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt, and the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad. So I had one for dessert. Expressing more than just the malaise of someone suffering from a hangover, Sunday Morning Coming Down gives a voice to feelings of spiritual abandonment that borders on the absolute. Nothing short of dying is the way the chorus describes the desolation that the song's protagonist is experiencing. Steeped in a neo-romantic sensibility that's owed as much to John Keats as to the Beat Generation and Bob Dylan, Mr. Christopherson's work explored the themes of freedom and commitment, alienation and desire, darkness and light. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. He wrote that in Me and Bobby McGee. Janis Joplin, with whom Mr. Christopherson was briefly involved with romantically, had a posthumous number one single with her plaintive recording of that song in 1971. Later that year, Help Me Make It Through the Night became a number one country and top 10 pop hit in a heart-stopping performance by Sammy Smith. The composition won Mr. Christopherson a Grammy Award for Country Song of the Year in 1972. It was a heady time to be a songwriter in Nashville when Mr. Christopherson fell in with a gifted circle of like-minded and similar bacchanalian tunesmiths who were often driven to succeed, as he was. Roger Miller and Willie Nelson among them. We took it seriously enough to think that our work was important, to think that we were creating what would mean something in the big picture, Mr. Christopherson said in an interview with the journal No Depression in 2006. Looking back on it, I feel like it was kind of our Paris in the 20s, he went on, alluding to the American expatriate writers like Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein, who lived there at the time. Real creative and real exciting and intense. Mr. Christopherson's raspy, at times pitch-indifferent vocals never gained much traction with commercial radio. One notable exception was the gospel sophist Why Me, a number one country and top 40 pop hit released on the Monumental label in 1973. Another gospel song of his, One Day at a Time, written with Marjon Wilkin, was a number one country single for the singer Christy Lane in 1980. Then Hollywood beckoned. Mr. Christopherson and Rita Coolidge, who were married for much of the 70s, won Grammy Awards for Best Country Vocal Performance by a duo or a group with From the Bottle to the Bottom and, in 1973 and in 1975, Lover Please. They also appeared in movies together, including Sam Peckinpah's gritty 1973 Western Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, in which Mr. Christopherson played the outlaw Billy the Kid. Peckinpah cast Mr. Christopherson in the film after seeing him perform at the Troubadour in Los Angeles and in Cisco Pipe in 1972, which was his movie debut. With rugged good looks that lent themselves to the big screen, Mr. Christopherson was soon cast by Martin Scorsese as the iconic male lead alongside Ellen Burstyn in the critically acclaimed 1974 drama Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. He later starred opposite Barbra Streisand in Frank Pearson's 1976 remake of A Star Is Born, a performance for which he won a Golden Globe Award. Over four decades, Mr. Christopherson acted in more than 50 films, including the 1980 box office failure Heaven's Gates, and with John Sayles' Oscar-nominated 1996 neo-western Lone Star. Singer-songwriters may not be the likeliest of movie stars, but Mr. Christopherson consistently revealed an onstage magnetism and a command that made him an exception to the rule. In 2006, he was inducted into the Texas Hall of Fame, along with Matthew McConaughey, Sybil Shepherd, and Joe Beth Williams. His last major hit as a recording artist was The Highwaymen, a number one country single in 1985 by The Highwaymen is an outlaw country supergroup that included his longtime friends Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, and Johnny Cash. Mr. Cash and his wife June Carter Cash played a pivotal role in Mr. Christopherson's budding career when they invited him to appear with them in 1969 at the Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island. He was still a scuffling songwriter at that time, having worked as a janitor at Columbia Studios in Nashville, where he later recalled emptying ashtrays and waste paper baskets during the sessions of Mr. Dylan's Blonde on Blonde double album, released in 1966. Immobilized by stage fright at Newport that night, Mr. Christopherson might have forfeited his opportunity had it not been for the encouragement of Ms. Carter Cash, who was, as her husband recalled in an interview, all but dragged him on stage with them. The evening proved exceptional, exposing Mr. Christopherson to a national audience after he received a highly favorable mention in the New York Times the next day. If there was one thing that got my performing career started, it was right then, said Mr. Christopherson, reflecting on the experiences quoted in his 2013 book, Outlaw, Waylon Willie Chris and the Renegades of Nashville, by Michael Stresgut. Chris Christopherson was born on June 22, 1936, in Brownsville, Texas, the elder of three children of Mary Ann Ashbrook and Lawrence Henry Christopherson. His father was a major general in the Air Force, and he strongly urged his son to pursue a military career. The family later moved west, and in 1954, Mr. Christopherson graduated from San Mateo High School in Northern California, where he distinguished himself in both academics and athletics. He was subsequently featured as a promising boxer in Sports Illustrated Faces in the Crowd series in 1958. Mr. Christopherson graduated with honors and a degree in literature from Pomona College in Claremont, California, in 1958. He also had prize-winning entrees into a collegiate short story contest sponsored by the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Before being awarded a Rhodes Scholarship to study English literature at Oxford. Under the pseudonym Chris Carson, he made a fruitless bid to become a pop star while there, working with Tony Hatch, the British impresario known for his success with the singer Petula Clark. Mr. Christopherson graduated from Merton College, Oxford, in 1960. And received a commission as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army in 1961, he married Frances Beer and was stationed in Germany where he served as a helicopter pilot. He attained the rank of captain in 1965 and achieved an appointment to teach English at West Point. He ultimately declined that position, trading the comforts it might have afforded for the penury of life as a would-be songwriter in Nashville. If his wife was crestfallen by that move, his parents were scandalized. For a while, they disowned him for throwing away everything that he had worked so hard to achieve. "Not many cats I knew bailed out like I did," Mr. Christopherson told the New York Times Magazine in 1970, talking about this tumultuous period during which he and his wife divorced. "When I made the break, I didn't realize how much I was shocking the folks, because I always thought they knew I was going to be a writer. But I think they thought a writer was a guy in tweeds with a pipe. And when I quit and didn't hear from them for a while, I wouldn't want to go through it again," he continued, "but it's part of what I am." Success in Nashville eluded Mr. Christopherson at first, and not without reason. According to Ms. Wilking, the first publisher to sign him to a songwriting deal, he had a few things to learn and unlearn, before he arrived at the distinctive mix of vernacular and sophisticated idioms that became his stock in trade. He had been a poet and an English reacher, so his songs were too long and too perfect, said Miss Wilkins in a 2003 interview with the Nashville Scene magazine. His grammar was too perfect. He had to learn the way people talk. His transformation as a songwriter involved more than merely sprinkling colloquialisms like ain't nothing into his lyrics. He also cultivated a keen melodic sensibility, a languid expressiveness that bore little resemblance to the straightforward Hank Williams-derived shuffles he was turning out when he first arrived in Nashville. "I had to get better," Mr. Christopherson once said, and he reflected on the lean years before he broke through as a songwriter. "I was spending every second I could hanging out and writing and bouncing off the heads of other writers." He also changed publishers, leaving Ms. Wilkins' Buckhorn Music for Combined Music, owned by the producer Fred Foster, who also had the freewheeling likes of Shel Silverstein and Mickey Newberry under contract. In 1970, Mr. Foster issued on his independent label Monument, Christopherson, Mr. Christopherson's debut as a recording artist. The album contained versions of several songs that he had been made hits for other artists, including Me and Bobby McGee, for which Mr. Foster was credited as a co-writer. That song was originally recorded by Roger Miller, who had a top 20 hit with it in 1969. Mr. Christopherson released other albums in the 1970s to mix reviews, and by the decade's end, his career in movies began to eclipse his reputation as a singer-songwriter. In the 80s and the 90s, his music took an activist turn, with lyrics championing social justice and human rights. "What About Me?" a song from his 1986 album, Repossessed, spoke out against the right-wing military aggression in Central America. He also became a prominent defender of the singer Sinead O'Connor in 1992 after she caused an uproar by ending a performance on Saturday Night Live by tearing up a photo of Pope John Paul II in protest against sexual abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. "Maybe she's crazy. Maybe she ain't," Mr. Christopherson wrote in response to her critics. "But so was Picasso, and so were the saints." Later that year, he tried to comfort her on stage when she appeared in a star-studded concert at Madison Square Garden, celebrating Bob Dylan's 30 years as a recording artist, and she was met by resounding boos. Bypass surgery in 1999 slowed him down a bit, as did extended bout with Lyme's disease in the decade that followed. But he remained active into his 80s. Mr. Christopherson was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2004. By that time, he had already been elected to the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1977 and the National Academy of Popular Music Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1985. He also received a Lifetime Achievement Award in the 2014 Grammy Awards. Mr. Christopherson is survived by Lisa Myers Christopherson, his wife of over 40 years, their sons, Jesse, Jody, Johnny, and Blake, and a daughter, Kelly Marie, a son, Chris, and a daughter, Tracy, from his marriage to Ms. Beers, and a daughter, Casey, from his marriage to Ms. Rita Coolidge, and seven grandchildren. A man of prodigious gifts and appetites, Mr. Christopherson struggled early on with what path to pursue among the many that were open to him. In the song, The Pilgrim, chapter 33, he seemed to acknowledge as much, depicting a conflicted figure much like himself, who took every wrong direction in his lonely way back home. Such self-deprecation notwithstanding, he believed that songwriting, certainly a wrong direction in the eyes of his family, was at least at first a means through which he could discover his vocation in life, and by which he achieved celebrity and artistic acclaim. "I wouldn't be doing any of it if it weren't for writing," Mr. Christopherson said, looking back on his career in a 2006 interview with the online magazine Country Standard Time. Quote, "I never would have gotten to make records if I didn't write. I wouldn't have gotten to tour without it, and I never would have been asked to act in a movie if I hadn't been known as a writer." The occupation listed on his passport was writer. And that article, as an obituary, appeared this week in the New York Times. And it was written by Bill Frisky's Warren, published on September 29th, and entitled "Chris Christopherson, Country Singer, Songwriter, and Actor, Dies at 88. In a companion article, and also in the New York Times, entitled "Chris Christopherson Stood by Sinead O'Connor as the Booze Rained Down," and it was written by Mark Tracy, published September 30th, 2024. A moment when the Irish singer had few people defending her, the country music veteran showed strong support. It created a bond that remained throughout their lives. On October 16, 1992, Columbia Records threw its longtime artist Bob Dylan an event at Madison Square Garden to celebrate the 30th anniversary of his first album with that label. The concert, available on pay-per-view, featured performances by Dylan along with some of the biggest stars of the time, Stevie Wonder, George Harrison, Johnny Cash, and even Eric Clapton, but it was the performance by the comparatively newcomer Sinead O'Connor, and the assist lent her by the country veteran Chris Christopherson, who died Sunday at 88, that provided most memorable. O'Connor, then just 25, was at the center of Firestone. Just 2 weeks earlier, the Irish singer was a musical guest on the Saturday Night Live show when, at the conclusion of her second and final performance of the evening, she ripped up a pitcher of Pope John Paul II and extorted, "Fight the real enemy." It was a defiant act of protest against the sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and also, she later revealed, a deeply personal statement. The photograph had belonged to her mother, who had physically abused her. The incident drew widespread outrage and turned O'Connor into a cultural pariah. Now, in the wake of that polarizing moment, it was Christopherson who was tasked with bringing Miss O'Connor onto the stage. I'm real proud to introduce this next artist, whose name has become synonymous with courage and integrity, said Christofferson, in an obvious reference to the Saturday Night Live incident. As he would later sing of O'Connor, she told them her truth just as hard as she could. Her measure profoundly was misunderstood. O'Connor took the stage to a cascade of applause and boos, which did not let up as Miss O'Connor stood silently at the microphone with her hands behind her back. A minute passed, and Christofferson reemerged from the stage left, put his arm around O'Connor, and whispered something in her ear. As the pianist played the opening of O'Connor's scheduled song, the Dylan track, I Believe in You, O'Connor motioned the band to stop and proceeded to perform an a cappella version of Bob Marley's War, the same song from that fateful Saturday Night Live performance, and a confrontational track with lyrics primarily drawn from a speech of the Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, who had delivered them at the United Nations. O'Connor ended the song and defiantly regarded the audience as the jeering persisted and began to exit the stage, but not before Christofferson again approached her and embraced her and walked off with her. The moment connected the two musicians, the grizzled country songwriter and actor from Texas and the sweet-voiced singer from Dublin, for the rest of their lives. O'Connor died last year at 56. Christofferson appeared with her in a 1997 music video for the song This Is to Mother You. In 2010, the two performed a duet of Christofferson's Help Me Make It Through the Night on an Irish talk show. It was a year after Christofferson had realized a song about the 1992 incident called Sister Shanae. On that talk show appearance, Christofferson recalled the 1992 evening in Madison Square Garden in more detail. As the hostile crowd threatened to drown out O'Connor's performance that night, the concert organizers had asked Christofferson to escort her off the stage. He refused, and instead went out and told her, "Don't let these bastards get you down." To which he said and responded, "I'm not down." In her 2021 memoir, Rememberings, O'Connor had a slightly less rosy telling of the events. She wrote that when she saw Christofferson approaching her, she thought, "I don't need a man to rescue me, thank you." As they went off stage, she added, "She almost threw up on him. It just seemed to be so wrong, booing that little girl out there," Christofferson added after all these years later. "She always had courage." And as he sang in the song, Sister Shanae, "And maybe she's crazy, and maybe she ain't, but so was Picasso, and he wasn't the saint, and never has been partial to shackles or chains. She's too old for breaking, and too young to tame." And that article appeared in the New York Times, entitled Chris Christofferson Stood by Shanae O'Connor As the Boos Rained Down. It's written by Mark Tracy and published on September 30th, 2024. Next, we have an article on DelanceyPlace.com, an online magazine full of eclectic things to think about. It's entitled Legendary Disgrace Producer and Phil Spector, 10-324. It's from a book, in Waiting for the Sun, A Rock and Roll History of Los Angeles by Barney Hoskins. Phil Spector was one of the great producers of early rock and roll, responsible for such classics as the Do Run Run, Then He Kissed Me, and Be My Baby, as well as later collaborations with the Beatles. Spector went on to prison after his conviction in 2009 for the murder of actress Lana Clarkson. By the summer of 1962, Harvey Philip Spector was already a music biz whiz kid, an obsessive dweeb with a Jewish mother from hell and a father dead by his own hand. Little Phil was possessed with an outside ego. With his taller, better-looking chum, Marshall Lieb, I was really Phil's bodyguard, he formed the Teddy Boys, the Teddy Bears, and they had a hit with To Know Him Is to Love Him. a throwaway B-side cut at the Gold Star Records in July 1958. You never saw such a complete change in a little Jewish guy, Grouch Lou Bedell, the crusty co-owner of Dora Records. But the truth is that Phil had mapped out his pop destiny long before the Teddy Bears. By the time Lou Chud had signed the Teddy Bears to Imperial Records for 3 flop singles and 1 thoroughly icky album, Spector was a magnetic presence on the L.A. scene, attracting such disciples as Future Runner Brothers honcho Rush Tilleman and sometimes Mother Magic Band member Elliot Inger to his side. Moreover, he was already experimenting in the studio, bouncing tracks and stacking vocals to build his primitive pop sound. The Teddy Bears were one of the first hit groups out of L.A., said Lou Adler. They were sort of the beginning of the West Coast pop business. Following the dissolution of the Teddy Bears in the spring of 59, Spector approached X-Sparks record Lester Still for advice on his next move in the music business. Still had been impressed watching Phil at work in master recorders the year before and offered to take the super brat to Phoenix to meet Lee Hazelwood, with whom he had briefly run Atlantic's unsuccessful East-West label in 1957-58. In Hazelwood's Ramco studio, where Duane Eddy had cut a string of instrumental hits for Jamie Records, Spector observed the creation of Eddy's famous guitar twang with the aid of a storage tank echo chamber. Unfortunately, Hazelwood found Spector almost as obnoxious as Lou Bedell had done, so he's packed him off to New York to serve a rather different apprenticeship with Jerry Lieber and Mike Strola. New York taught Spector everything he needed to know about pop. Not even did he learn from Lieber and Strober themselves, but also co-writing Benny King's Spanish Harlem with Lieber in the process. And he produced a handful of sessions by artists on Atlanta Records, Atlantic Records, and other labels, including MusiCore, Gene Pitney's Orgasmic Every Breath I Take. Yet his biggest hit in 61 was cut back in L.A. after Lester Still had asked him to fly home and produce a trio called the Paris Sisters. The group's I Love You, How You Love Me had reached number 5, and October was almost as sickly sweet as to know him as to love him, but it gave the 20-year-old Spector sufficient confidence to propose the formation with Still of a new label, eventually christened Phillies. And back in New York, he found that the Crystals, through publisher Hill and Range, and earmarked them for that label. Then on the recommendation of the Snuff Garrett, but to the surprise of most onlookers, he took a $25,000 year as Liberty Man in New York. Garrett was to rue the day he persuaded the company to hire this kid he called a megalomaniac, for little did he know for 5 months except to bide his time behind a vast conference table playing air hockey. Phil Spector's great period started the week after he quit Liberty and went back to L.A. with a demo of Gene Pitney's song, and they were going forward and faster, and they became even more famous as the time went on, including his famous wall of sound that he created in New York with the Crystals, and a wonderful Barry man, Cynthia Well, Pagan to Manhattan, that said, "That's going to be the thing that has now. The West Coast people will never be able to manage the East Coast sound." "He's a rebel," was the first blast of that wall of sound, as a patented stifling summer heat in the studio. It was a teen theme. It was Spector's best and early hit. Behind his audacious behavior were laid profound insecurities. Malou Adler called a black vocal quartet called the Alicats to come to Gold Star to record. He sensed the competition from Spector. Phil could never accept anybody being on a level with him, he recalled engineer said Larry Levon, and when Spector's 2 Italian lieutenants, Nino Timpo and Sonny Bono, were successful in their own right, he felt incredibly threatened. That article appeared on thelannyplace.com. It's really a review of a book, and a book about Phil Spector entitled Rock and Roll History of Los Angeles by Barney Hoskins. And that's all the time we have for Music News Today. I'm Butch Ball with the Virginia Voice. Thanks for listening.